Hi there.
But you noticed I was here. So.
I saw that you were online. You came online.
I did. I'm on
the line. I realized the other day that the word online is ridiculous.
Well, as are so many words that have, you know, diverged so much from their original meanings.
So in the Hamilton podcast that we do on The Incomparable, I recorded an intro that I haven't changed since episode 2. And one of the things, and I just made it up as I went along. And one of the things that's in there is, you know, visit us online at theincomparable.com/podforham. And I thought, online. And I keep thinking about it. And it's like, you know, that's dumb. That's dumb. It's a dumb concept online. First off, though, it doesn't mean anything anymore. And everything is online. Everything is in the internet, lowercase I, by the way, as of June 1st, according to the Associated Press.
Yeah, I don't know. It is kind of a holdover. But again, I think there are so many things that, you know, end up meaning something so different from when they originally started. Because there was a time when online, you know, it was a distinction, right? It had meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it was a place that you had to go. You had to have a modem. You know, you had to get a beep.
Yeah, I mean, like,
and then you were online.
Logging on, even yes. As a concept, right? Like that. I mean, we still have logins and passwords, and probably will forever.
There was literally a line you had to be on in order to be on the internet, right? And
yeah, exactly.
I was listening to the live stream of Accidental Tech Podcast, so it'll probably be up in the next day. Last night while I was making dinner, and they were talking about modems because John Siracusa was cleaning modems out of his attic, or boxes that might have had modems in them.
Now the modems can really accumulate if you don't get it fumigated properly.
Well,
be careful.
That's why you got to clear it out every so often. But I was thinking about it, and Casey did the thing that he does that I love, but also is definitely a very Casey thing. It's like his love of vinyl, which is, but there was something about those days where you had to go online and you heard the modem sound and you didn't know if it was going to connect. And then it finally connected and you thought, oh, yeah. And then you were on the internet. And I thought, no, I feel no nostalgia for that. Now I'm always on the internet. Now I can go to a computer and go boop, 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 and something comes up, whereas back in the old days you had to like make an effort to get to connect your computer with the world. That's
it's
dumb.
It's romanticizing it in the same way that we romanticize periods, you know, even
the good old
as far
days
back,
of
yeah,
anything.
The medieval days, right? Oh wait, they didn't have indoor plumbing or heating, probably wasn't that great, but
yeah. or you know, mouth care or deodorant.
I think the thing that appeals to many of the nerds of our era about that particular time is it was like being in on something, right? Like, because not everybody, it's not like today where everybody is constantly connected all the time, or at least it feels like that. It was that you had to like, it was arcane, right? Like you had to know something, and once you were there, you felt like you were part of like a secret club to a certain extent.
You had to do like a magic spell. You had to do an invocation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Does that mean it was better? Absolutely not.
No.
But that is what we remember about it, was the idea that it was somehow set us apart from other people because we were engaging in some sort of, you know, community that other people were not aware of. And it did feel like almost like a cabal, even though there were millions of people on it. Like, it felt weirdly like secretive. So I can understand the romanticizing of it, even if it doesn't match up with the reality of it.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, words change as part of that. And, you know, everybody likes to be prescriptive and say, no, this is the right way to do it. And if you're somebody like the Associated Press, you know, what the reason the AP style book exists, which did, for those who don't know, change the new edition that was out, came out yesterday, was lowercase is internet now. It's not special anymore. It's just a word. It doesn't get a capital I anymore. That exists because if you're a publication, you have a style guide so you can be consistent. It doesn't necessarily mean things are right or wrong. It's just about being consistent. You know, but people like to be prescriptive and say, no, you have to do it this way. This is the only right way to do it. And, that's not realistic. I mean, there are things that are right and wrong, but there's a whole lot of gray areas where things can be kind of anyway, because language is always changing. But still, I have those moments where I think, wow, that is a vestigial word. It was a new word 20 years ago, and it's already kind of moved on where it made sense at the time, and we didn't have a better word for it. And now it doesn't make a lot of sense. And online is one of those.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about briefly, although it may not have made it into the actual podcast, I think. I just finished reading Between You and Me, which is by Mary Norris, who is a copy editor at The New Yorker.
Oh,
and
right,
it is fabulous and just
fantastic. I'm doing my laundry in the background here, so please enjoy the sounds of my laundry. I didn't turn off the laundry to
it
do
is,
the
it
secret
is.
Podcast.
There's a little clunking. It's fine.
I just want people out there who are the Six Color subscribers to get the realism of where I work every day.
It's the ambiance.
Which is just, let's listen for a moment. Oh, yeah, that's laundry.
Slowly being driven mad.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like about this book is that she's very aware that, you know, a lot of this is, so, you know, copy editing is a very specific craft. And it's not just a prescriptive book of do's and don'ts. It's really an interesting dive into why, like, just the evolution and use of so many of these terms that do seem outmoded. I was endlessly fascinated by it. She's got an entire section, an entire chapter on profanity, which is amazing. She's gotten in, like, a bunch of chapters on various punctuation marks, and everyone is littered with sort of exceptions to the rule, right? Like, of the idea of, she'll talk about, say, you know, semicolons, and then bring up a particular writer who's like, but these semicolons, they make, like, the way this writer, you know, from the 19th century used semicolons, they're totally wrong, but it's great. We're going to leave it in because it has to do with, like, the flavor of that writing. And if you took, and she gives examples where she, like, takes them out and it's like, it doesn't read the same way, even though, like, they don't necessarily follow the rules, the quote unquote rules about how that should work. There's something about it that makes it work in that scenario. And so having that, you know, obviously copy editing is a very, like, having a style guide is about being fastidious about detail and about keeping consistency. But I also like the idea that there, you know, people recognize there are going to be exceptions. There's going to be times when something doesn't work and you leave it in because that's what the author wanted, especially in things like fiction. She talks about where it's like the rules are very different in fiction than in writing, like, a nonfiction piece. But it's a fascinating read if you're at all interested about usage, about grammar and spelling and punctuation. It's great. It's really a terrific read, and it's very funny.
So did you read Eat, Shoots, and Leaves? Because that was the book
she
that it sounds the most like.
She mentions, she in fact talks about Eat, Shoots, and Leaves in the book, and praises Lynn Schulte, which I do love Eat, Shoots, and Leaves as well. I have that somewhere in my collection of grammar and language books over here.
Yeah, writing nerds.
We are writing nerds. It's true.
Yeah, but I mean, words matter, and everybody's got opinions about words. Even if they're not writers, they have opinions about things, or things, or they affect you, and the words hit you the wrong way, but I thought it was worth talking about, given that it came up a couple of times this week with the internet thing, and also, like, yeah, after we were done with Clockwise yesterday, we talked about it a little bit, about the difference between farther and further and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And Allison, who was on that episode, she's very much a proscriptive person. She's like, that's not the way to do it. And she didn't respond to my thing, which is, well, actually, you know, words just want to be free, man. That's, yes. I had that moment of like, words can have usage. Let's expand the usage a little bit, because that's, some people don't like to hear that. And again, I'm not advocating for things being wrong, but we have a reader who occasionally sends us corrections to our spelling and grammar, some of which are correct because we type something wrong and it goes out that way. But every now and then he sends in something and I look at it and I'm like, no. That's also perfectly valid, but the way I wrote it is fine.
Right. It's the fundamental. There are basically two large camps, which are the prescriptivists, as you mentioned, who are like, this is the way you should use it.
Right.
And the descriptivists, who are like, this is the way it's being used. I think I go back and forth. Like, I do think there is something to be said about rules and imparting clarity. But at the same time, you should not let that get in the way of, we would go nowhere if language was static, right? Like, the whole part about language evolving is what makes it fascinating, and English in particular, because it's such a hodgepodge of all these different heritages, and the fact that it is so lax about some things is amazing.
That's the thing about English people who are super prescriptive about grammar is, of all the languages, I mean, of all the languages, I was watching the Scripps National Spelling Bee last week, and what's funny about it is the concept of a spelling bee basically doesn't work in other languages, because most languages have clear rules about how you spell things based on how words sound, and English doesn't. And so and it was just fascinating, because like English, like famously, people will say things like you can't end a sentence with a preposition, or you can't split an infinitive. And most of those are literally just taking rules from languages like Latin and applying them to English. But there's no reason why those rules would apply to English at all. Right. And now, clarity, there may be clarity issues,
sure,
but to say
absolutely.
To boldly go where no man has gone before is not, or no one, if you're a Next Generation fan, and not a sexist like Captain Kirk, then it's fine. It's fine to split that infinitive. It's just fine.
And I think what people take for granted about English, which is also one of its most fascinating elastic qualities, is the fluidity with which you can create neologisms, like new words, right? Like that is incredibly, again, not even that it's difficult in other languages. It's just not done in the same way. Like English as a language is so flexible and so loose when it comes to word structure that people just like gluing new words together and making new words all the time is, I think that's one reason that English has evolved to become sort of the lingua franca of today's world.
Ironically.
That was Frankish, I believe it actually came from, even before French. And so what's fascinating about it is that it's, I think the reason that we see so much technology, you know, English describing technology permeating other cultures is just because it's so easy to just come up with new words for things and apply even old words to new contexts. Something like online, to go back to our beginning of this mm-hmm. conversation, you know, it evolved very quickly from going online, two words, right, to being online as a state of something that doesn't really is a it's a totally vague concept, right? Like, what, as you said earlier, what like, line are you on? You were like on a line before, but...
In cyberspace, I mean, it's that kind of idea, right? It's like in the internet, in the computer world, that's not the world that's the... I mean, it's quote-unquote real world again. Because I mean, but what does it mean? There's no great word for it. And so we apply these words to it. In the Scripps National Spelling Bee, one of the things that made me laugh is they had words, because English imports words from other languages, right, all the time. And so many of the weird words that are hard to spell at the spelling bee are weird words because they come from German and Italian and Japanese and Spanish by way of Mexico and some
Arabic, Native French, accents. Pretty much everything. Yeah.
So they had one word that was from Hawaiian, and I just laughed because anybody who knows anything about Hawaiian knows that you literally can't misspell words in Hawaiian because it's a one to one correlation of sounds with spelling.
Right. Right.
And so I laughed because that was literally that word was in there to trip somebody up who didn't study how you pronounce words in Hawaiian, and the kid nailed it in like 30 seconds. He had blown through it and answered the question, because I said, come on, even I know how to spell that word because it's Hawaiian and all the words. But that's what English does, is we grab these words and we mush them together. It's an interesting thing about our native language is that it's, you know, it started out as kind of what was it? It started out as Celtic that was overrun by Germanic and then later overrun by French Frankish words and French words. And so it's just sort of like taken on layers, and then it just accumulates other words. And it's a fun. I will recommend a book too, since we are on this tangent, which is The Mother Tongue, English and How It Got That Way by Bill Bryson.
I have a copy of that sitting here as well.
Fantastic. I may need to buy a copy of that at some point, because my copy basically was so battered because I read it so many times and loaned it out so many times. I'm not sure if we even have it anymore. The cover was falling off, but that's a great book about the history of English and how weird it is. And what strange places the words come from. But anyway, that's the tool that we have to use every day. And whether we're talking on a podcast or writing articles, it's like language matters. And that's the other thing, is that language matters, even if you're somebody who, like I just said earlier, is kind of a language hippie to a certain extent and says, come on, man, words can mean lots of things. But, you know, the ultimate goal is communication and clarity. And rules exist for that. Rules don't exist to you know, show your superiority over someone else or exert some sort of narrow authority. The rules really exist that I think mattered because you want to be able to communicate and be clear. And there's a famously, we were talking about it in the Incomparable Slack the last week, there was an article posted on the web. I'm not going to get into what it was about or anything like that, but posted on the web where a writer kind of stepped in it, and his piece the next day where he was responding to the people reacting to him stepping in it was basically, you misunderstood me, it's your fault because you misunderstood me. And I thought, actually, you know, if they misunderstood you, it's because you didn't do your job at communicating your point well.
And yeah, telling somebody they didn't get the point never really goes over well when you're a writer, because
it's your fault. Right.
Ultimately, the fault is always on you. You're the person who put your ideas out there.
That's right. If you can't, if everybody misunderstood you, guess what? Or if a lot of people misunderstood you, it's your fault. It's not them for being dumb or whatever. It is you for failing to communicate properly.
As the old saying goes, if you meet a jerk in the morning, they're a jerk. If you meet jerks all day, you're the jerk.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So some wisdom from the Six Color Secret Subscriber Podcast this week. Deep, deep, deep thoughts. What else going on? Let's see. The Code Conference, which used to be the D Conference, is going on. I know you wrote a little thing about Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk both spoke and said sort of interesting things.
Elon Musk is he's a fascinating guy.
He's read a lot of sci-fi. He has read a lot of sci-fi. You can tell he's I mean, not just because he names the ships, the SpaceX drone ships are all named after things from the Ian Banks culture series, but like when he talks about, oh yeah, reality's probably a simulation, we're probably all living inside a simulation, it's like, yeah, you know, maybe. Could be online, cyberspace, whatever. But
we're living in a simulation that is running its own simulations. Oof.
But he did try to be sort of like welcoming of Apple if Apple's building a car, while at the same time saying a little bit like maybe it's too late, and a version of phone guys, you know, computer guys aren't going to walk right in. They're not going to walk right into the phone market. He did a little of that. But, you know, he's also right. There's a lot to learn in the car market, and Apple is trying to learn it kind of silently on the side.
Yeah, it's like trying to boil the ocean, right? Like, it is hard. You can do it. Climate change, I guess, could eventually boil the oceans. That would be really unfortunate. But trying to sort of take in everything and gulp it all down, and then just sort of like spew out the one perfect object there, like an oyster creating a pearl, I feel like is very difficult. And I think that's the reason there have been so many leaks about this process, is that it's impossible to do silently. They're going to keep some stuff under wraps pretty well, because that's the way Apple rolls. But these days, especially when you're building something that is a physical object, it's really hard to keep that entirely silent, as we've seen, you know, even between iPhone leaks, and this week there was some possibly leaked top case for the new MacBook Pro revision. And so when you look at all these things, it's like, well, if you're making something, you know, especially something that is intended to be mass produced, it's really hard to do that without being quiet. But in terms of like learning everything there is to know, this is an enormous industry. And unlike going into the smartphone or even the computer industry, which are definitely industries Apple entered after they had sort of, you know, started out, the car industry has been around for a century. You know, it is, and that makes it both a ripe target for someone to come in and shake things up, but it also means there is a lot of accumulated knowledge that you either have to tap into, or, you know, decide you're going to ignore wholesale, and a lot of times on a point-by-point basis of saying, like, all right, we're not going to do things this way, say, internal combustion engines, even though that's the way we've been really doing things for 100 years, because that's not efficient, and it's bad for the environment, and it's expensive, requires lots of moving parts, etc. But there's a lot of other stuff that goes into building a car that you have to sort of be able to, you know, figure out why people have done things the way they have before you're going to sort of throw it all out the window.
The spin cycle has started here, so apologies. My laundry is spinning. I wanted to ask you about Bezos, because you wrote a little post on Six Colors about it. He gave a little indication of what the holdup is in terms of getting an Amazon Video app on the Apple TV, which seems to be that they're holding it up purposefully as a part of their dispute with Apple over the 30% that Apple wants to take from all transactions.
Yeah, it's a weird choice on Bezos' part to he doesn't directly shine a light on that, because it's sort of in response to a question from, I believe, Neela Patel, which asked if that was the reason that, you know, Amazon hasn't done a sort of Amazon video app for the Apple TV yet. And the weird thing about it is that there's already an Amazon video app for the iPad and the iPhone, and as several commenters have pointed out when we talked about it on Clockwise this week, you can use AirPlay from that app and put it on your Apple TV, which is fine. It's not necessarily the best solution. I would certainly prefer there to be a built-in app, but it seems a little ridiculous to say, oh, we're not going to do this because the business decisions have been bad, even though the same app basically already exists.
And they're not pulling it off of iOS.
Exactly.
Because right? It's too
right.
important for them to have it on iOS. And Comixology isn't going off of iOS, right? And Kindle
right.
isn't going off
they've,
of
they've
iOS.
Done this. They've done this three or four times now, where they've basically, you know, as you're creating a subscription service, and yes, the tricky thing about discussing Amazon is always they have multiple facets to their video business, because they have their Prime, you know, Prime Instant Video, which is basically a Netflix competitor. You pay a subscription, you get access to a library of content that you can stream wherever, whenever for free. They at the same time have a Amazon video service that's more like iTunes, where you can rent or buy shows. They also then kind of package those both into the same service, even though they're not really the same thing.
Right. So if you buy a movie on Amazon and load it up in the iOS app, it will load up. So
correct.
It's not just for the free streaming. It's not just like an Amazon Prime free streaming app. It'll also pick up your purchases from Amazon.
Right. And that's an end run around the whole 30% issue, because you're buying it via a web browser somewhere.
Same as Kindle or Comixology, where you're buying those on the web or on some other device online. And and then they just show up on the iOS app, because the app can't do the commerce itself.
Right. And it's inconvenient, perhaps, if you're a customer and you're like, oh, I need to figure out how to go get this video and make it show up on my iOS device, which is one reason I'm sure that Amazon would prefer to be able to deploy its own very extensively developed payment system right there. And one thing I suggested a few months ago, I wrote a column over at Macworld that was talking about how I think Apple Pay could actually help solve this problem, because Apple also has this weird dichotomy where they have Apple Pay and they have in-app purchases. In-app purchases used primarily for digital content, or you know, when you're buying, like, you know, coins for your favorite iOS game or what have you, and Apple Pay used primarily for physical goods. But there is some weird overlap in there, and the distinction sometimes about what works with what seems kind of arbitrary. So could they instead basically deploy Apple Pay through apps that, like, don't want to use iOS's in-app purchase? Possibly. I mean, you know, if Amazon's going to do the heavy lifting and develop its own system for buying things, why not just let them use Apple Pay as sort of a payment method, but still have Amazon essentially do the payment processing? And if for folks who don't want to sort of reinvent the wheel and say, oh, you know what, it's just too much of a time and a headache to figure out how to create my whole system, I'm happy to trade 30% of that revenue to Apple for basically having a totally freely baked system that I can very easily implement. I think there's a possibility there of essentially allowing us to get the best of both worlds. Because Amazon's never going to make all of its Kindle books available via in-app purchase, because they're simply not going to hand 30% of all that revenue to Apple.
Well,
makes
Apple,
no sense.
Apple's 30% is based entirely around the idea that Apple is the middleman between creators of content and consumers of content. And the problem is, if you're the middleman, Apple is basically telling you, give us your cut as the middleman. And that doesn't make any sense.
That's Amazon's business.
And Amazon is the middleman. Amazon does not make most of this stuff. Amazon is selling you something from someone else. They are taking, you know, they're taking a little bit of a cut, and that's how selling stuff works. When Apple is selling things on iTunes or in iBooks or anything like that, it's the same deal, right? The problem is you can't stack two middlemen on each other. And that's what the Apple 30% thing basically says.
Unless,
it's like, we're the only allowable middleman on iOS. That's
right.
It.
Unless you jack up the price, right? Like, and some cases
right.
have done this with.
Somebody asked me about this some of the monthly fees, like Hulu or,
yep,
or
Netflix.
You can buy it in app, but it just costs more, which is weird. But somebody asked me about this because they were asking me why the Comixology app doesn't let you buy comics, but the Marvel Comics app and the DC Comics app let you buy comics because they're the same app. They're literally the same app, white label version run by Comixology that is just Marvel Comics is the Marvel Comics app. There's also a Marvel Unlimited app, but the Marvel Comics app is from Comixology. And you can still buy things via in-app purchase in there. So if you want to buy Marvel Comics on your iPad, get the Marvel Comics app and you can do it. And they sync to the Comixology app. So what he asked me was why? And my answer was pretty simple. It's Marvel is selling Marvel's comics through the Marvel Comics app. They basically don't have a middleman in that scenario. I'm sure behind the scenes they're paying Comixology for probably a percentage or whatever. But from that perspective, Marvel can take a hit. Apple's 30% hit, which they were already taking, and they're fine with it. But Comixology, as a middleman owned by Amazon now, can't take that same hit because their business model just will not support it at those prices, and they'll have to eat it or like completely renegotiate their deals with all the publishers. So the thing that makes the most sense is that on the Marvel app, there's no middleman essentially, and Marvel can choose to let Apple be their middleman and give them the 30%, and it just comes out of their profit margin, but they still presumably have a pretty decent one on per comic sold. The apps with the middleman can't do it.
Right. So Comixology is getting that cut, essentially, or some version of it when it sells Marvel comics, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, right. Amazon and Comixology are, and that's how they stay in business, right? Because they don't make their own comics. That's how they make money. Exactly. That's how Comixology makes money, is to pay for the app they build and the e-commerce infrastructure that they built up, is that they take a cut. They also make money through things like white labeling for Marvel and DC. Although, you know, at any point that could go away and those publishers could build their own apps, having you and I both used and written about the Marvel Unlimited app, having done that, I would say smart move by Marvel to just white label the Comixology app, because it's way better than the Marvel Unlimited app. Even though the Marvel Unlimited app is better than it used to be, it's still not even close to how good the Comixology app is. So they make some money that way, but they don't want to just be in that business. They want to be like a storefront, and that's why Amazon bought them, is that Amazon totally gets that. That's what the business that Amazon's in.
Yep. So Amazon basically, rather than having to make its own inroad into comics, which it kind of tried for a while, you could buy comics and read them in the Kindle app for a while, but it was kind of a mess.
Yeah, they've actually unified that now, which is kind of brilliant. So David Steinberger, who is the CEO at Comixology, is also basically the Amazon vice president in charge of comics. He's in charge of the comics line at Amazon as well. And they've synced it all up now, where you can log into Comixology with your Amazon account. Yeah. I had a few comics that I bought or somebody gifted me on Amazon that they're now in they've synced into my Comixology account. So it's all kind of coming together where, Amazon's kind of finally gotten that, because the experience of comics on the Kindle app was not great. And so now it's all synced in with Comixology, which is cool.
Yeah. So I don't buy, to go back to the original point, I don't really buy Bezos's, he basically chalked this up to like business practices that are acceptable is when we'll put an Amazon app on the Apple TV. You're being it's about business.
But
there's no question
that's
about
BS,
that.
Though, I mean, really, you know, what it's really about is I want to withhold
it's a bargaining chip
from Apple's box, because it makes Apple's box less valuable. It makes Amazon's core customers more likely to buy a different box, maybe an Amazon box or a box made by somebody who's got better business terms than Apple. Why would I want to strengthen Apple's hand here? And so I'm going to withhold it. And that's what he could have said and didn't say. You can make this about, again, I see Amazon's side here. I really do. As a middleman, Apple is insisting on 30% from all transactions is really rough for them. I get that part, but that's what this is about, is kneecapping the Apple TV as a product among Amazon's core customers, because they would rather people buy boxes that Amazon can sell products on directly. Apple?
It's the same reason that Amazon stopped selling the Apple TV. Because it doesn't support Amazon Video, says the company who could actually put Amazon Video on there. But like, it's all part of the same thing, right? It's all about a bargaining chip, and it's all about leverage.
And why did they not do that on iOS? It's because there are too many iOS users and they can't turn their back on that, but they can turn their back on the Apple TV because there is a workaround with AirPlay, and because you can be an iOS user and still, buy an Amazon Fire TV or a Roku or something like that.
Is that a particularly good move for Amazon? I'm not convinced that it is, but I understand. I see where they're coming from.
I feel like Amazon's best move is to be everywhere and to make you
agree.
because although it's true, you may pick up some people who say, oh, well, I'm not going to buy an Apple TV. I'm going to buy a Roku or a Fire TV because I rely on Amazon Video. You know, there are a lot of people who also have Apple content and no other device is going to have the Apple content. So you're sort of asking people to do those people to pick or have two boxes, which is dumb. Some of us do. I have more than one and you have more than one, but, you know, better to be everywhere and then just compete, right? I mean, to say
you're selling a service, you're selling a platform. It behooves you to be everywhere. You're gonna pick up more customers from your Prime memberships than you are gonna pick up customers of the Fire TV, even if the Fire TV is a decent box and it's perfectly fine. But you're definitely gonna get more traction by bringing in more customers by being where they are.
Yeah, so, behooves.
Otherwise, you can't play.
Is an interesting word. Have hooves?
Probably. I have to look it up. I bet you there's a good etymology about that somewhere.
Also related to heave. I don't even know.
I'll have to look up the book I am now reading to go circle back around. I am now reading a book. I'm going to try to pronounce it correctly because the word is a little wacky. The Etymologicon, which is by Mark Forsyth, and I believe is sort of based on he was like a language blogger or something, and so he sort of done this book. And it's interesting because it's just they're just these small entries about words, and then he talks about like what other words they're related to and where they sort of derive from, and then at the end it sort of segues into the next block, which is very clever. It's a very easy read, but it's very interesting.
So we'll wrap it all the way back around by saying one of your posts, I think Monday this week, was about it was a wish list item, and the wish list item was the dictionary interface on iOS, which I think such a great point you make here about something missing.
I was prompted to do this because I was reading these books about language and I kept wanting to look things up, and it would be like I was reading this book in paper, so like I can't tap on the paper and obviously bring up a definition. So obviously I can search via the web, but iOS has a great built-in dictionary. It's stored on the device, so it works offline. And so essentially you can tap on any word and usually choose define, and get a nice little slide up panel, and it gives you the whole definition. It's great. I really like it. The problem is there's just no way to get at it otherwise. You have to. So I end up doing these stupid things where I like start blank emails, type the word I want to know and tap it and get define and hit define. And there's a little interface in there, which makes me wonder, why can't I just do this? Because on the Mac side, there is a dictionary app. It's standalone. It's very easy to search or browse if you're so inclined. And I really like that, and I use it a lot. I also use it through Spotlight, since Spotlight can look up dictionary definitions on OS X, but it can't do it on iOS, which I also think is kind of perplexing, because all the information is there. It seems like they should just be able to wire that together. In the past, I've used third-party apps. There are definitely third-party apps you can do. I got at least one suggestion for basically a workflow created with the app workflow that could make that a little bit easier. And I've gotten a couple other suggestions here and there. But, you know, this is, again, I feel like this is something Apple can do. It would be easy, and it would just make things nicer. I like looking up words.
Yeah, it's one of those things that... It should be there, right? I mean, I know there are dictionary apps for iOS. They were some of the greatest early iOS apps. I've still got one, I think, on my phone. Man, but, nice. You know, I think, I think at the very least that you keep the database on the phone and have it be or on the device and you have it just be searchable in Spotlight. Because it is on the device, right? You can look up words.
Yep.
So, how do I actually just type in a word and look it up? And putting it in Spotlight seems like that would be a really
the easiest
answer.
Thing. Yeah. You can do Siri, and that is someone suggested that. And then my point was, I'm not always in a place where I want to use Siri to look something up. And they said, well, you can start a Siri query and then tap something and type define, because there is that fake, text interface. I was like, that's not much better than my stupid workaround at that point.
It's a workaround to what should be a feature. feature, which is why even, it's a wish list item.
Yeah, even if it doesn't turn up to be a separate app, because I think in that case, lots of people would just throw it in there. You know, these are the stupid Apple apps I can never get rid of folder. I think that having it in Spotlight would be a great addition, or even just when you bring up that panel that you use to define a word, if you could have a search field there or even just a browse thing where I can look through, that would be fantastic as well. Yeah. So make my wording life easier, Apple.
Yeah. Well, thanks to everybody out there for listening to this this podcast and subscribing to Six Colors. We appreciate it. You help us keep the lights on. We sent out a Six Colors magazine last week, and I hope you enjoyed it. There was a lot of fun stuff in there. I wrote about weather stations and other things. And if you didn't get it, you can take advantage of another new feature of the website, which is if you go to the subscriber page, sixcolors.com/subscribe, you'll find that there's now a thing that says if you're already a member, sign in to gain access to all your extras. If you sign in there, you will actually, that page will magically transform into a page that has amazing. A link to the RSS feed for this podcast and an archive of all of the Six Colors magazine issues that we published so far. So finally, you can log in somewhere and see your stuff, which
and
is a good thing.
As a reminder to our listeners and people who read the magazine, Jason and I do a column in there by request every month.
Yes.
If you have a question for us, pretty much about anything, really. Like, we've written about tea in the past, right? I mean, if you want to sling, do you want to sling about words, writing? You know, do you have questions about that? You can give us an email or contact us on Twitter or wherever else you might send smoke signals. I don't know. And ask, and we might answer your question in the magazine next month.
That's right. And that would be very useful because I've got a little backlog, but it would be nice to get some new questions. And random questions are good. I think that's where the weather station came from, was somebody asked me, you keep talking about the weather station. What's the story there? And so I had been meaning to write something about that. And instead of posting it on the site for the world to see, I posted that on in the magazine instead. Oh, and I will also say, now that we have a secret place where we can put things like links to the magazine back issues and stuff like that, this also means that if you wanted to forward your magazine to somebody at some point to share it with them and suggest perhaps that they also should subscribe, it's safer now because there aren't any secret links in there anymore, because I can hide the secret links behind the login screen and just tell people to go and log in and get the secret links. So that was one of my challenges in setting all this up, was having it be a little more shareable. So anyway, it's still a lot of security honor system stuff. Like, you know, theoretically you could be listening to this and have, you know, subscribed and then canceled your subscription to Six Colors, and I haven't changed the feed, which I probably will do at some point, but I haven't yet. All I can do is say shame.
Well, we trust you. We trust you. That's folks, not to do that, except you over there,
except
in the
for
corner.
That one, not you personally, but that one over in the
that
corner.
That person.
There.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some honor system stuff here, but that's, you know, it's easier to do that than build some sort of really ridiculous rigmarole. So that was alliterative there, wasn't it, Dan?
Indeed. I like some good alliteration. It's awesome.
Anyway, not the same sound. Thanks to everybody for listening. We'll be back next week, right, Dan?
Indeed, we will.
All right. We'll see you then. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.